You know, and we reconvene with the Life Divine this evening. We begin part two in the second book. The book is the Life Divine. Book one had a title called Omnipresent Reality and the Universe. Book two was titled The Knowledge and the Ignorance, the Spiritual Evolution. Part one of book two, which we just completed last week, was The Infinite Consciousness and the Ignorance. Tonight, part two introduces us to the knowledge and the spiritual evolution. So far, then, he has described an omnipresent reality, a conscious being whose existence is everywhere, whose self-experience is one of delight fundamentally. The nature of the universe is to represent this conscious being whose nature is delight, to take its unity, its oneness, and distribute it infinitely in a manifest cosmos, which, however large it might be, is only a small representation of what is truly infinite. And then he describes the whole scale of being, how this magnificent construct comes to place itself in what seems to be its nethermost opposite, how this supreme light becomes darkness, how this unity becomes division, how delight becomes insentience, all the way down to the root in and below matter. And then how evolution, climbing out of matter, traces progress into life, into the arrival of mind, and pushing us beyond. And what is it that is key to the cosmos in advancing this quest but the soul? The soul, too, is a reality within a universal manifestation. Both universe and individual are expressions of that which is nameless, beyond all definition, beyond any determination. So, he describes then this entire chain of involution down into matter and an evolution from matter up until we become conscious enough, aware enough, that we can wake to the spirituality within and around us and begin to compose the possibility of a different consciousness in our own being. Then, of course, that was book one. In book two, he asked and framed the larger philosophic question is, how can this reality frame itself in a universe which so limits it? What is the nature of cosmos? What is the nature of the individual? How is it that ignorance can arise? And how is it that ignorance can result in active evil? Well, he's explained all of that. And now he'll begin to talk to us about the nature of an integrative knowledge, a knowledge that restores unity, that finds the essence and works to find the essence in all levels of being, and thus finding a power to unite them all can unify and reconstruct that from which we came. In other words, without losing the manyness of the creation, we can arrive again at the oneness that gave birth to it. So this progression reclaims both the individual and the universe, redeems it in a way. With this growing power and awareness of oneness, until we gain a level of consciousness and evolve beyond mentality into a supramental awareness, awareness beyond mind. So now we're ready, I think, for chapter 15. This was originally chapter 32 in the Arya as it appeared, and it first appeared in March 1917, 100 years ago. And this chapter is called Reality and the Integral Knowledge. It was originally called the Integral Knowledge. This place is called the Integral Knowledge Study Center. So I think it's apropos of this evening that we, in March 2017, take up this chapter. So let's begin. Chapter 15, Reality and the Integral Knowledge. He begins always with citations, what he calls mottos, drawn from the Veda or Vedanta. Originally, the two citations were from the Isha Upanishad, verse 11, and a verse taken from the Rig Veda. Now he has substituted two other things from the greater Vedantic tradition. The first from the Mundaka Upanishad, which is not one of the earliest Upanishads, one of the later. And it says, this self, Atman, is to be won by the truth, Satyena, and by an integral knowledge, Samyajnanena. So to get to the essence of things is to get to the truth, to get a knowledge that comprises all possibilities into a fused singleness is the knowledge that is integral. The next is from the Gita. Hear how thou shalt know me in my totality, samagram mam, for even of the seekers who have achieved, hardly one knows me in all the truth of my being. Siddhanam kaschin mam beti tatvata. So even if we arrive at a perception of the spiritual reality behind the universe, we may not understand how that self deploys itself in all the ranges of being in the cosmos, and even within ourselves. We become aware of the essence. Ah, but what about its motility? What about its capacity to shapeshift, to become many things without losing its oneness? If we don't have that knowledge too, we don't have an integral knowledge. We have something essential, but it is not final. So, now we begin. He offers a succinct summary of where we've been over the last several hundred pages, all in the span of a couple of sentences. This, then, is the origin. This, the nature. These, the boundaries of the ignorance. Its origin is a limitation of knowledge. Its distinctive character, a separation of the being from its own integrality and entire reality. Its boundaries are determined by this separative development of the consciousness, for it shuts us to our true self, and to the true self and whole nature of things, and obliges us to live in an apparent surface existence. So ignorance is a limitation. It is a separation of being from the essence and from all around. A return, he says, or a progress to integrality, a disappearance of the limitation, a breaking down of separativeness, an overpassing of boundaries, a recovery of our essential and whole reality must be the sign and opposite character of the inner turn towards knowledge. So this relinking, this erasure of fictional division, this restoration of unity, this is the signature of knowledge. There must be a replacement of a limited and separative by an essential and integral consciousness identified with the original truth and the whole truth of self and existence. The integral knowledge is something that is already there in the integral reality. It is not a new or still non-existent thing that has to be created, acquired, learned, invented, or built up by the mind. It must rather be discovered or uncovered. It is a truth that is self-revealed to a spiritual endeavor, for it is there veiled in our deeper and greater self. It is the very stuff of our own spiritual consciousness. And it is by awaking to it, even in our surface self, that we have to possess it. There is an integral self-knowledge that we have to recover, and because the world self also is our self, an integral world knowledge. A knowledge that can be learned or constructed by the mind exists and has its value, but that is not what is meant when we speak of the knowledge and the ignorance. So, in the involution of that conscious force into the various modes of nature, there is installed an inherent knowledge which will reappear in the course of evolution. It is ever present, just like all reality is ever present. We don't have to invent it. We have to discover the interiority of the world and live from the inside out, and then we begin to understand the method, the meaning of the process, the emergence of knowledge leading to greater knowledge, going from light to greater light, from dawn to greater dawn. And it is revealed to us as we grow. This is what a spiritual endeavor is. It's not to become more and more chaste, more and more pure, and more perfect, but become larger and larger in the continent of our consciousness, so that there are no walls, so that we are one with the transcendent, absorbed, but also including the universe. We are an aspect of the universe, but in a sense, the universe also lives inside of us. And who are we? What are we? We are a spark of that central fire. So we can't rest with just an essential liberation, a discovery that our soul is not chained finally by the exigencies of the body, that we are a greater reality than the limits of our lifespan, that we are immortal, eternal aspects of this supreme consciousness, not different from it, not erased in the oblivion of time. No. But this knowledge takes us beyond this self-discovery into the discovery of this self, which is involved in all the modes of being. And it justifies, therefore, the whole meaning, the whole thrust of the universe. It is a yes to manifestation, not a no. An integral spiritual consciousness carries in it a knowledge of all the terms of being. It links the highest to the lowest through all the mediating terms and achieves an indivisible whole. At the highest summit of things, it opens to the reality, ineffable because superconscient to all but its own self-awareness of the absolute. At the lowest end of our being, it perceives the inconscience from which our evolution begins. But at the same time, it is aware of the one and the all self-involved in those depths. It unveils the secret consciousness in the inconscience. Interpretative, revelatory, moving between these two extremes, its vision discovers the manifestation of the one in the many, the identity of the infinite in the disparity of things finite, the presence of the timeless eternal in eternal time. It is this seeing that illumines for it the meaning of the universe. This consciousness does not abolish the universe. It takes it up and transforms it by giving to it its hidden significance. It does not abolish the individual existence. It transforms the individual being and nature by revealing to them their true significance and enabling them to overcome their separateness from the divine reality and the divine nature. So the integral consciousness is aware of the one, all the way from the inconscient to the superconscient, including all the spheres in between. Transcendent, in essence, the integral knowledge housed in that is an aspect, as we'll see, of the supramental consciousness, the truth consciousness. And as it becomes integral, as it becomes master of our being, it transforms the individual and has the capacity, the potential to transform the universe through the transformed individual. So, if we find this wide term of being in ourselves, then it becomes possible for the cosmos too. So we are important, more than important, we are urgent to the cosmos. He continues, an integral knowledge presupposes an integral reality. This refers back to the first paragraph. For it is the power of a truth consciousness, which is itself the consciousness of the reality. But our idea and sense of reality vary with our status and movement of consciousness, its sight, its stress, its intake of things. That sight or stress can be intensive and exclusive or extensive, inclusive and comprehensive. It is quite possible, and it is in its own field a valid movement for our thought and for a very high line of spiritual achievement, to affirm the existence of the ineffable absolute, to emphasize its sole reality, and to negate and abolish for ourself, to expunge from our idea and sense of reality the individual being and the cosmic creation. The reality of the individual is Brahman the Absolute. The reality of the cosmos is Brahman the Absolute. The individual is a phenomenon, a temporal appearance in the cosmos. The cosmos itself is a phenomenon, a larger and more complex temporal appearance. The two terms, knowledge and ignorance, belong only to this appearance. In order to reach an absolute superconsciousness, both have to be transcended. Ego consciousness and cosmic consciousness are extinguished in that supreme transcendence, and there remains only the absolute. For the absolute Brahman exists only in its own identity and is beyond all other knowledge. There, the very idea of the knower and the known, and therefore of the knowledge in which they meet and become one, disappears, is transcended, and loses its validity, so that, to mind and speech, the absolute Brahman must remain always unattainable. in opposition to the view we have put forward, or in completion of it, the view of the ignorance itself as only either a limited or an involved action of the divine knowledge, limited in the partly conscient, involved in the inconscient, we might say from this other end of the scale of things that knowledge itself is only a higher ignorance, since it stops short of the absolute reality, which is self-evident to itself, but to mind unknowable. This absolutism corresponds to a truth of thought and to a truth of supreme experience in the spiritual consciousness, but by itself, it is not the whole of spiritual thought, complete and comprehensive, and it does not exhaust the possibilities of the supreme spiritual experience. So here he's given voice to the philosophy of Advaita Vedanta, the philosophy of non-dualism, that the universe is ultimately unreal, dissolvable back into the absolute beyond, that the individual too is a fiction, dissolvable back to the absolute beyond, and that we can find an experience of this absolute which stands far removed from manifestation in either cosmic or individual form. This is true. Sri Aurobindo does not dispute that. There is a transcendent. But the universe and the individual, he will say, are terms of that transcendent in self-expression. That transcendence is not remote, is not an absolute without being, without capacity. Having conscious power of its own, it can move. Being always, it can become. So, but if you have this experience where the universe seems to fall away from you, then rational philosophy can be drawn up which is in accord with that. And that is, of course, the philosophy of Shankara. And it is a great philosophy, and we do not deny the spiritual experience behind, but we do intend to point out the limitations of its integrality as applied to the universe at large. The absolutist view of reality, consciousness and knowledge, is founded on one side of the earliest Vedantic thought, but it is not the whole of that thinking. And here he's talking about Shankara's Advaita. In the Upanishads, in the inspired scripture of the most ancient Vedanta, we find the affirmation of the absolute, the experience concept of the utter and ineffable transcendence. But we find also, not in contradiction to it, but as its corollary, an affirmation of the cosmic divinity, an experience concept of the cosmic self, and the becoming of Brahman in the universe. Let's pause and look at that for a moment. If you've read Shankara closely, you've seen that he pits his foundation of Vedanta upon the Upanishads. All of his logic is pinned on the Upanishads. Because the Upanishad says this, then this must all be true. The problem for Shankara is that he has to twist often the meaning of the Upanishads, which have a clear expression affirming the reality of the world and of the essential reality of the individual, despite his idea that there is only a transcendent one, and there is no manyness, and there is no universe. So the Upanishads, in other words, oppose Shankara's viewpoint, really. The other thing to remember is that Sri Aurobindo pins his philosophy upon finally experience itself. It can't simply be the word of a text received, an Upanishad, a Bible, something like that, which is your final authority. No, you must go inside and in an adventure of consciousness, Discover the truth for yourself. And along the way, find out where your mood-making and myth-making and projecting philosophies based on a limited experience and correct for that. And arrive an experience that goes beyond distinction of subject and object, which unifies and which has that authentic character to it. It is only authentic experience of that kind that liberates. But that is the beginning of spiritual knowledge and the kind of knowledge that he refers to. It is what led him to write all of this philosophy. It is not philosophy moving from presuppositions to conclusions. It does not have axioms based on anything other than his rooted self-experience of that. And he calls us to confirm and discover for ourselves whether it is not true. So, equally, we find the affirmation of the divine reality in the individual. This, too, is an experience concept. It is seized upon not as an appearance, but as an actual becoming. In place of a sole, supreme, exclusive affirmation, negating all else than the transcendent absolute, we find a comprehensive affirmation carried to its farthest conclusion. This concept of reality and of knowledge enveloping in one view the cosmic and the absolute coincides fundamentally with our own, for it implies that the ignorance, too, is a half-veiled part of the knowledge and world knowledge, a part of self-knowledge. The Isha Upanishad insists on the unity and reality of all the manifestations of the Absolute. Remember that it was a citation from the Isha, verse 11, that originally began this chapter when the Arya was published in journal form. It refuses to confine truth to any one aspect. Brahman is the stable and the mobile, the eternal and the external, all that is near and all that is far, whether spiritually or in the extension of time and space. It is the being and all becomings, the pure and silent, who is without feature or action, and the seer and thinker, who organizes the world and its objects. It is the one who becomes all that we are sensible of in the universe, the immanent, and that in which he takes up his dwelling. Well, you can see that he's summarizing the Isha Upanishad. All the verses virtually of the Isha appear here in one form or the other, in rhyme or in assonance. The Upanishad affirms the perfect and the liberating knowledge to be that which excludes neither the self nor its creations. The liberated spirit sees all these as becomings of the self-existent in an internal vision and by a consciousness which perceives the universe within itself instead of looking out on it, like the limited and egoistic mind, as a thing other than itself. Verses 6 through 8. To live in the cosmic ignorance is a blindness, but to confine oneself in an exclusive absolutism of knowledge is also a blindness. We've moved from the 9th to the 12th. To know Brahman as at once, to gather the knowledge and the ignorance, to attain to the supreme status at once by the becoming and the non-becoming, to relate together realization of the transcendent and the cosmic self, to achieve foundation in the supramundane and a self-aware manifestation in the mundane is the integral knowledge. That is the possession of immortality. So from verse 6 to 14, he's covered it all. It is this whole consciousness with its complete knowledge that builds the foundation of the life divine and makes its attainment possible. It follows that the absolute reality of the absolute must be not a rigid, indeterminable oneness, not an infinity vacant of all that is not a pure self-existence, attainable only by the exclusion of the many and the finite, but something which is beyond these definitions, beyond indeed any description, either positive or negative. All affirmations and negations are expressive of its aspects, and it is through both a supreme affirmation and a supreme negation that we can arrive at the absolute. This idea of the foundation of the life divine, you may recall that before Sri Aurobindo ever began working on this long series of essays, that he had in his private notebook a monograph which he called The Life Divine. And what it was a lengthy commentary on the Isha Upanishad, the only Upanishad which is an actual part of a Veda. All affirmations and negations are expressive of its aspects. Because, if you remember the early chapters, what you can say about that unknowable is that near to us it is a being, a conscious reality whose nature is delight. But even that positive expression of itself does not absolutely confine it, because it is something even beyond, unknowable, unattainable, exceeding even the positive definition of what is real. You cannot say that it is unreal. That is going too far. That is a contradiction of its own being. But that it exceeds even its own definition and determinations as an absolute, as a oneness, as a manifest universe. It is always free, even of that. This is the foundation that we look at, and why it is true to say that the mind falls back on attaining from that. We approach that, we cannot know it. We know objects exterior to ourselves. That is the kind of knowledge that the human has. But that is beyond subject-object, beyond any definition, any categorization of being. So we continue. On the one side, then, presented to us as the reality, we have an absolute self-existence, an eternal soul, self-being, and through the experience of the silent and inactive self, or the detached, immobile Purusha, we can move towards this featureless and relationless absolute, negate the actions of the creative power, whether that be an illusory maya or a formative prakriti, pass from all circling in cosmic error into the eternal peace and silence, get rid of our personal existence, and find or lose ourselves in that sole true existence. So we can absorb ourselves in that self-existence, the reality of Atman, Sat. On the other side, we have a becoming which is a true movement of being. And both the being and the becoming are truths of one absolute reality, that unknowable Abba. That manifestation is real being. That real being becoming the many-sided becoming of the universe and of us. The first view is founded on the metaphysical conception which formulates an extreme perception in our thought, an exclusive experience in our consciousness of the Absolute as a reality void of all relations and determinations. That imposes as its consequence a logical and practical necessity to deny the world of relativities as a falsity of unreal being, a non-existent, a sat, or at least a lower and evanescent, temporal and pragmatic self-experience. And to cut it away from the consciousness in order to arrive at liberation of the spirit from its false perceptions or its inferior creations. The second view is based on the conception of the Absolute as neither positively nor negatively limitable. It is beyond all relations in the sense that it is not bound by any relativities or limitable by them in its power of being. It cannot be tied down and circumscribed by our relative conceptions, highest or lowest, positive or negative. It is bound neither by our knowledge nor by our ignorance. It is bound neither by, It is bound neither by our knowledge nor by our ignorance, neither by our concept of existence nor by our concept of non-existence. But neither can it be limited by any incapacity to contain, sustain, create, or manifest relations. On the contrary, the power to manifest itself in infinity of unity and infinity of multiplicity can be regarded as an inherent force, sign, result of its very absoluteness. And this possibility is in itself a sufficient explanation of cosmic existence. The Absolute cannot indeed be bound in its nature to manifest a cosmos of relations, but neither can it be bound not to manifest any cosmos. It is not itself a sheer emptiness, for a vacant Absolute is no Absolute. Our conception of a void or zero is only a conceptual sign of our mental inability to know or grasp it. It bears in itself some ineffable essentiality of all that is and all that can be. And since it holds in itself this essentiality and this possibility, it must also hold in itself in some way of its absoluteness, either the permanent truth or the inherent, even if latent, realizable actuality of all that is fundamental to our or the world's existence. It is this realizable actuality actualized, or this permanent truth deploying its possibilities, that we call manifestation and see as the universe. So this refers you back to the earliest chapters of the Life Divine, where he was going through a description of how this unknowable can be viewed as being which has latent within it, innately, this power of consciousness, this power of expansion, that it can express itself limitlessly to the view. So, this argument, you know, takes in the dialectic from the Advaita, treats it, gives it its just place, but calls a halt to its philosophy as it advances improperly into what the divine itself may or may not ultimately do. Because it has a justifiable experience of this absolute beyond, it cannot say that this manifestation is impossible, that the divine in its innate being does not contain this power, which may or may not be expressed. It is free to do or free not to do. And in the doing, it is not chained to the becoming. It remains free, ever free. This is, in fact, the larger limits of our own spiritual possibilities, that we can ourselves be fully invested in the cosmos as souls actively evolving, tasting, digesting, going on to greater experiences as we meet and embrace the cosmos, and yet at one and the same time be wrapped inside in our own essence of being, which is one with that. Never depart from the eternal, even though we move in time. Never lose that innate peace, even though we are in dynamic expression, even though we dance. We are still in the center of our being. Let me note that next week we return to daylight saving time. Let us see what we save. But something to be noted, because our friends joining us from India would be asked to rise an hour earlier to be able to join us for these sessions. So tonight to Savitri, and we look at Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 7, the Cosmic Spirit and Cosmic Consciousness. There the unreal could not find a place. The sense of unreality was slain. There all was conscious, made of the infinite. All had a substance of eternity. Yet this was the same indecipherable. It seemed to cast from it universe like a dream, vanishing forever into an original void. But this was no more some vague ubiquitous point or a cipher of vastness in unreal naught. It was the same, but now no more seemed far to the living clasp of her recovered soul. It was herself. It was the self of all. It was the reality of existing things. It was the consciousness of all that lived and felt and saw. It was timelessness and time. It was the bliss of formlessness and form. It was all love and the one beloved's arms. It was sight and thought in one all-seeing mind. It was joy of being on the peaks of God. She passed beyond time into eternity, slipped out of space, and became the infinite. Her being rose into unreachable heights and found no end of its journey in the self. It plunged into the unfathomable deeps and found no end to the silent mystery that held all world within one lonely breast, yet harbored all creation's multitudes. She was all vastness and one measureless point. She was a height beyond heights, a depth beyond depths. She lived in the everlasting and was all that harbors death and bears the wheeling hours. All contraries were true in one huge spirit, surpassing measure, change, and circumstance. An individual, one with cosmic self in the heart of the transcendence miracle and the secret of world personality, was the creator and the lord of all. Mind was a single, innumerable look upon himself and all that he became. Life was his drama and the vast a stage. The universe was his body, God its soul. All was one single, immense reality. All its innumerable phenomenon. So, thank you for your time and attention. We continue our adventure towards a life divine. Namaste, Jai Ma.